Professor Dyson, Professor Gestricht, Dr. Schelkle, ladies and gentlemen, gives me great pleasure to welcome you to the 10th annual lecture on contemporary German history, jointly organized by the German Historical Institute and the German Embassy. You all know the old adage, whoever forgets the past is condemned to repeat it. If we do not know whence we come, we shall not be able to form a clear idea about whither we go. And as our people are at the crossroads of some momentous decisions, it may be well to reflect on history. History doesn't speak itself to us. It needs the interpretation of historians. And this is where debate and controversies arise. I always welcome such clashes of opinion because truth, at least temporal truth, I cannot speak for eternal truth, is never revealed but reached through a painful process of assertion and contradiction. The choice of this year's talk shows that Europe as a topic has lost none of its relevance. The Euro crisis has fueled negative images and perceptions of Europe as a clumsy, inefficient, bureaucratic monstrosity, catering only for the needs of a few hegemons and an elitist class of bureaucrats in Brussels. EU skeptics and some agenda-driven media have seized on the crisis to impress upon the public mind that Europe is a lost cause. Now, I quite readily acknowledge that the European Union is in urgent need of reform. But arguments about the European Union should be based on facts, not fiction, on sober analysis, and not on hysterical prejudices, on a careful pondering of alternatives, and not on impulsive flights of fancy. And above all, it may be true about the European Union what Churchill once said about democracy. It may be the worst form of international peaceful cooperation, except all the other forms that have been tried from time to time. Let us look at economics. The EU remains Britain's biggest trading partner. British exports to the federal land of North Rhine-Westphalia are fourfold the total of all British exports to Australia, New Zealand, and India taken together. Yes, there may be more growth in emerging markets, but that's a truism, because if they did not grow, they would not emerge. But that does not mean that Europe is a submerging economy, quite the contrary. In terms of innovation, quality, advanced technologies, Europe plays in the top league and will continue to do so, simply because our educational system turns out people with qualifications you can't get anywhere else? Or why do Chinese, Indians, Brazilians flock to our universities? The debate on Britain's future inside or outside of Europe will have to be concluded by the British people themselves. And as a diplomat, I feel reluctant to give good or maybe bad advice. I insist, however, that arguments in whichever directions they are exchanged should be sound and based on factual evidence. And I must say that I feel sometimes a little bit amused that the same people and papers that keep arguing towards the Scots that together is better seem to forget exactly that logic and think the other way around when it comes to the EU. As you all know, the alternative to something bad must not necessarily be something good. It can be something definitely worse. And history shows that, alas, that has been far more often the case. So I sincerely hope when we come together for the 20th annual history lecture in 10 years' time, the UK will still be an important and self-confident partner in the EU. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a great privilege for me to welcome Professor Dyson. I wish to extend my special thanks to Professor Gestrich and his team here at the German Historical Institute for hosting this event. Unfortunately, our residence is undergoing some urgent repair and we cannot use it at the moment. And of course, I'm particularly delighted that we have today with us Dr. Waltraud Schelkle from the London School of Economics, who has kindly agreed to give a short commentary on the lecture and lead the discussion with the audience afterwards. Thank you very much for your attention.
Professor Dyson, Dr. Adam, Dr. Schelkle, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the German Historical Institute. It's a great pleasure for me to open again this 10th annual lecture on contemporary German history, and it's a privilege to have it here, even if the occasion is a sad one that the embassy has to undergo severe renovation. But it's a pleasure for us to have you here and to also to help out. Over the past 10 years, our joint lectures has covered many areas of contemporary German history and also of Anglo-German relations. However, time and again, Europe was either part of or at the center of these talks and debates. The European project is very much at the center of German politics, as we have just heard, and of German deliberations about the legacies of two world wars and the best means of overcoming the structural antagonisms which became so characteristic for the system of European international relations by the end of the 19th and in the first half of the 20th century. A system which at the Congress of Vienna in 1815 was designed to balance the interests of the European nation states, and this obviously became dysfunctional. Britain's relationship with the European project that emerged gradually after World War II was, for various reasons, as we all know and as we've just again heard, never easy. However, after 1989 and after 2007 and 2008, apprehension seems to have increased rather than decreased. There are clearly different visions and expectations what the functions of the European Union within a system of international relations should be. And many of these differences can probably only be understood, as Dr. Adam has always pointed out, if we take into account the different perspectives on the tragic history of the first half of the 20th century, but also on the much older traditions of thinking about state and state functions. It is therefore my great pleasure this evening to be able to welcome as this evening's distinguished speaker, Professor Kenneth Dyson from Cardiff University. He's one of those political scientists who have not only at their hands the tools of political and economic analysis, but also are able to position their subject and their methods into the wider context of the history of political ideas and of their of the movements of the academic field around them. Kenneth Dyson is not only in Britain but also internationally one of the doyens of European history and politics, and particularly of the European Union. He holds particular qualifications in economic history and has an immensely successful research record in particular this field, but also in the field of the history of political ideas. Kenneth Dyson started his academic career as a lecturer in politics at the University of Liverpool and was appointed professor of European Studies at Bradford University later on. Under his directorship, the Department of European Studies at Bradford became one of the top departments in this field in Britain. And since 2003, he's research professor in European politics at Cardiff University. However, Kenneth Dyson has also, as I already mentioned, wide historical interests, particularly in the history of political ideas, and was also elected fellow of the Royal Historical Society. His book on state tradition in Western Europe first published in 1980, is only one of his achievements in this field. The book has recently been republished in the ECPR Classics series, so it has become a household book for political scientists as well as for historians. And of course, we also have it in the library, and you can look at it over there. Together with Lucia Quaglia, he also edited a monumental two-volume collection of key political documents on European economic governance and policy with Oxford University Press. Right from the start of his academic career, Kenneth Dyson was interested in German politics in particular. His first book in 1977 was dedicated to the topic of party, state and bureaucracy in Western Germany. It was then followed by the massive volume which I already mentioned on the state in Western tradition. Since then, Kenneth Dyson has covered basically all aspects of German and also European politics. He is definitely not only a Germanist, he also works on France and Italy and particularly on comparative analysis. But he's covered many aspects, particularly also of German politics, from the problems of industrial crisis and unemployment over the politics of your economic reform in Germany to the political dimensions of the communications revolution on the European level. And particularly, of course, over the past years and in a really very, very impressively and prolific way, he published and researched on European monetary politics. One of the main books, The Road to Maastricht, Negotiated Economic and Monetary Union, was published in 1999 with Oxford University Press. And since then, he's contributed a vast range of articles, monographs, and edited volumes on the problems of the Economic Monetary Union publications, which were right from the start not without skepticism about some of the structural problems and shortcomings of this enterprise, but as far as I read them, with a clear sympathy, at least, for the larger aims of creating a Europe which is more than just an assembly of nation states. So we are extremely pleased to have you here this evening, and welcome to the German Historical Institute. Before I hand the floor over to you, I would also like to welcome Dr. Walkraut Schelkle from the London School of Economics. She, as Dr. Adam has already mentioned, is going to act as opening the discussion with a short comment and will guide us through the question and answers. Dr. Schelkle is also a very distinguished scholar on problems of European monetary history, economic history. She published widely in this field recently. She also started on economic policies in India, but her main field of work is now European economic history, and her second thesis, her German Habilitation, was on the new theory of monetary integration. So thank you also very much for doing this evening, and now I hand over to you, Kenneth. Thank you very much for coming, and we're greatly looking forward to the paper and the discussion.
Well, thank you very much for your kind introduction, and it's a great privilege to be here this evening. I appreciate all of you being here at 7:30-ish now, isn't it? I shall try to speak for no longer than 40, 50 minutes, if that is acceptable to you. Then we will have, hopefully, some kind of discussion. As you will be aware, I have selected a very big, challenging, and controversial topic. And I shall necessarily treat it in a broad brush manner. There will be many gaps in my analysis, and of course, you're perfectly at liberty to fill those gaps with some of your questions at the end. A note of caution at the beginning, a health warning if you like. I am neither a pessimist nor an optimist on the future of the euro, neither of these things inherently. I don't have a particular theory that leads me to a particular conclusion on this. though I read them. But I'm basically a Keynesian in this respect. My mind changes with the evidence. And the evidence, unfortunately, keeps changing as the events roll out, unfold before us. So I might describe myself perhaps as a possibilist. You never know. My talk is titled Germany, the Euro Crisis and the Future of Europe. And it paints a portrait of a hegemonic power. What I mean by a hegemonic power is a power that is capable of setting the terms of debate about the future of European economic governance. It has a capacity to frame how we debate the future of the European economy. But it's a portrait of a hegemonic power which is at once reluctant to assume liabilities within Europe, reluctant, not opposed to it, but reluctant, and at the same time is vulnerable to the consequences of assuming these liabilities. So this reluctance to assume liabilities and this vulnerability are, if you like to coin an Adenauer phrase, two sides of one and the same coin. And if you want to define what that coin has on it, basically what it's about, it is held together by a German preoccupation with retaining and if not enhancing its competitiveness and that of its partners in Europe, and retaining, crucially, its creditworthiness in the international financial markets, which is a public good it gives to the rest of Europe and without which the euro area would be in desperate trouble. So we have these two attributes of this hegemonic power. Now, what I'm going to do this evening, rather than speculate about the future and offer you my view of what the future will be, is to begin with history. And the point I want to make is that in historical terms, German attitudes to the euro crisis, Germany's approach to managing the euro crisis, reflects elements of historical normality. It's doing what a power of its type normally does historically, but also that it shows elements of historical distinctiveness. And some of those elements of historical distinctiveness I'm going to talk about raise worries, they raise concerns, and I hope to dispel those out for you fairly soon. You were talking in the introduction about history and the value of history to us, and I'm just reminded of Friedrich Nietzsche's aphorism, famous aphorism, when history speaks, it always speaks as an oracle. And I'm always very conscious that when I write about the euro, I'm more of a Cassandra. You know, I find myself, in a sense, finding in history warnings. And I'm reminded in particular, as I think about this, of the evidence given by the interwar governor of the Bank of England, Montague Norman, to the Macmillan Committee on Finance and Industry in 1931, when he lamented the lack of cooperation in tackling the emerging onset of the Great Depression, the lack of international cooperation, stating the problem is that negotiators in Europe will not address international issues on their own merits. They look at it from their national perspective. This statement of Montague Norman's, deeply pessimistic statement of Montague Norman's, was wholly correct. And I think it still points to an issue inside the euro area and more generally inside the global economy, which is namely that creditor states and debtor states approach problems with their own particular interests at heart. But the problem is that people will not look at how they should behave from the perspective of the sustainability of the international arrangements to which they have committed themselves. That is, I think, the great challenge. Once you've set up a monetary union, you have to commit yourself to delivering the requirements of sustaining that monetary union, and that is a huge challenge that is currently faced. Let me say something about why I think that German behaviour is simply consistent with historical pattern. By looking at three episodes, very briefly, the onset of the Great Depression in 1931-33, the negotiations at Bretton Woods, or leading to Bretton Woods, 1941-44, and the European Payments Union in the 1950s, which has been much neglected, but the study of which, I think, yields some very interesting insights. Let me begin with the onset of the Great Depression. In February 1931, the Bank of England was faced with, it was basically under siege in the financial markets. It was faced with the prospect of humiliating exit from the gold standard and a slippage of financial power from London to New York. It responded, February 1931, with the Kindersley-Norman Plan. Now, the Kindersley-Norman Plan has been much neglected, but let me just mention it quickly. The Kindersley-Norman Plan in 1931 envisaged transforming the new Bank for International Settlements in Basel into a huge supranational provider of international credits to debtor states. The main beneficiaries would be Austria and Germany. The projected scale of this institution is extraordinary by contemporary standards. At 2010 values, the Kindersley-Norman Plan was looking at an institution capable of mobilising £2.5 trillion. £2.5 trillion. This dwarfs the IMF today. It dwarfs the European Stability Mechanism. Now, the reason I mention it is because the plan was vetoed within 3 or 4 weeks by the French and the United States. They had no intention of transferring their gold reserves to this new Bank for International Settlements. In short, creditor state power, the power of the French and the US, triumphed over the radicalism of the Bank of England. Now, take a step back for a minute. The Bank of England isn't supposed to be radical, is it?
No.
But this, I mean, it is well worth reflecting on this particular document. It, coming at a time of emergency, the Bank of England was pushing for a new regime for international policy coordination and liquidity creation. France stood in the way of this bold supranational integration against both Britain and Germany. It was the French who were bullying the Austrians and the Germans then. These ideas were revived in Her Majesty's Treasury in June 1932, fell victim to the same process. Keynes followed this. Now, interesting that Keynesians have tended, the scholars of Keynes have tended to neglect this particular episode where the bank was being the radical institution. The bank is supposed to be the hostile to Keynes and all of that. Very interesting to see this. And of course, if we go on to look at the negotiations leading up to the IMF agreement, Bretton Woods, and all of that, you see Keynes reviving his ideas of 1933 for a big supranational credit provider, being vetoed again, being held back by the United States of America. On the liner transporting Keynes back from Bretton Woods, he reflected on the wisdom of advocating to the British cabinet that the British cabinet reject the IMF agreement. He didn't, but he reflected on it very seriously. What I'm giving you is a narrative, a historical narrative, of creditor state power and how it is used historically. Let me move on very quickly, I hope, if I don't get lost in details, to the European Payments Union of the 1950s, 1950 to 58. It's a fascinating historical period. The two main post-war European creditor states were Belgium and Switzerland. They took a very hard line on a very hard restrictive view on giving lines of credit to debtor states in Europe, a very restrictive view. The Belgians and the Swiss said, we're not going to join in this system unless you take a restrictive view of giving credits. You impose tight conditions on debtor states. By 1954, you had suddenly a resurgent German economy. It was the beneficiary of a major debt restructuring, international debt restructuring in 1953. And it then began to advocate a tightening of credit conditions in the EPU. Not before, but then, very quickly. By 1957-58, France had become the main reference point of German irritation, to put it mildly. There were very, very tough Franco-German disagreements at that time. Credit, yes, but only in return for very, very radical reforms in liberalization of markets and so forth in France. Charles de Gaulle, the new president, opted for a French currency reform and for domestic consolidation and liberalization as an alternative to a dependency relationship on the German creditor power. So my first point is this. Well before we have a European monetary system, an exchange rate mechanism and all of that, post-78, well before monetary union, German attitudes had crystallized. They were there. From 1954 onwards, there was continuity. German attitudes towards looking after German money in Europe didn't change with German unification radically. They didn't change with generational change later on. They were there. They were there already. This continuity in German attitudes was wholly consistent with earlier French attitudes, earlier US attitudes, the attitudes of a creditor state. It's a simple point, but it's a very basic and important point to bear in mind. Creditor state interests lie in limiting their liabilities in any system of international or European policy coordination and liquidity creation and management. And these interests get justified by reference to the same principles that creditor states believe in and they align themselves with. The avoidance of moral hazard. States should take individual responsibility for stability and sustainable growth. Stability begins at home. It doesn't begin with a creditor power, it begins with a debtor power. No bailout rules. Or, if bailout is conceded expediently, then only if creditor state liability is matched by creditor state control. That means ceding sovereign authority on the part of the debtor state, with all the problematic political implications that go with that. I'm going to make this point about historical continuity, because I'm going to relativize our view historically about Germany. There's a further element of historical continuity. In any system of international or European coordination, the historical pattern is that the number of debtor states exceeds the number of creditor states. This is always the case. Don't ask me why, please. This numeric disadvantage faced by creditor states in international coordination has positive and negative implications for creditor states like Germany. Let's look at the negative side. On the negative side, creditor states find themselves subjected to an external chorus of disapproval. This was true of the French in the late 1920s, early 1930s, true of the United States during the Bretton Woods Conference and after Bretton Woods. It's true of Germany. The external chorus of disapproval. Mrs. Merkel's experience at the G20 summit in December 2011 in Cannes. Now, it's a very classic example where the Americans and others were pushing for the idea that that Bundesbank gold reserves should be pooled at the European level. It's very similar to 1931. You know, the French resisting their gold reserves being pooled. No. The Americans resisting. The Germans are resisting. Plus ça change. And we see it again, of course. Now we have the US Treasury statements against Germany during this current month, and so forth. So the fear that haunts a creditor state is the fear of isolation. And I'll come back to that fear of isolation in a minute and what it means. But there is a positive side to the numeric disadvantage that creditor states have. On the positive side, creditor states have a powerful incentive to coordinate with each other. There may not be many of them, but they will coordinate strongly. What you get, you see it in the European Payments Union, you see it in the EMS, you see it now in the management of the euro crisis, is the emergence of an informal creditor state club. If you look at the underlying dynamics of how this crisis is being managed, watch how Germany, Finland, Luxembourg, the Netherlands caucuses. They caucus very, very tightly together. So one of the key attributes of the euro area crisis has been how this informal creditor state club has evolved, coalesced in its behavior. In contrast to that, despite their superior numbers, their numeric advantage, debtor states have greater problems of collective action. Why would that be the case? Their interests lie in differentiating themselves from each other. Ireland is not Greece. Spain is not Italy. Poland is not Hungary. The story goes on. You differentiate yourself from other debtors. It's very hard to get collective action amongst them. These characteristics of coalition behavior in European policy coordination stem from what I call the arguing and bargaining power possessed by creditor states. Arguing and bargaining power. They have an aura of power. Germany has an aura of power about it at the moment. It's associated with the structural attributes of the state. It's associated with its superior policy performance. Creditor states, their elites, have the capacity to frame debates about policy coordination, how much of it there should be, what kind of policy coordination would be, how much liquidity provision they should be. They set agendas. Others negotiate around their policy positions. You know, when the 2010 Greek crisis hit, and when the Council, the European Council, decided to set up a task force under Herman Van Rompuy, President of the Council, on reform of European economic governance, it met for the first time in May of 2010. It had only one paper before it. Was it a commission paper? No. The commission paper didn't come till about 5 weeks later. The only paper it had on the table was the German paper. And the German paper kept being refined. There were three German papers by the end of the day. I mean, the French papers, the Italian papers came way down the line. What the negotiations were, you know, rolling on towards their conclusion by then. It is this capacity. Others wait for the Germans to declare their position. This was true in the Delors Committee. Going back to 1988, we see absolutely classic. Everything was negotiated around the Bundesbank position. You'd ask people on the Delors Committee, how much of the result was determined by the Bundesbank? Oh, they'd say 96% of it, 98% of it, 95% of it. We're talking about big numbers. You know, why is that the case? The reason that that is the case is a creditor state has latent power. It doesn't necessarily have to be stated. It doesn't have to be used. But it is the latent power of exit from negotiations. no agreement on international policy coordination is credible without the creditor state there. So it has. Everybody knows you have to keep them at the table. If they decide to walk away from the table, you're going to get nowhere. You can't have an agreement without them. So it is. This is why they have this enormous power in the system. This was evident in the, you know, when Kevin and I did the Road to Maastricht book, it was very, very clear that this was how the Maastricht Treaty negotiations worked. It's very clear if you look at Huyperts and Verdun, this has happened with the Stability and Growth Pact negotiations in 1995-97. And, of course, creditor state power matters all that much more when the creditor state is a systemically significant state, like Germany was both before and after the foundation of the euro area. Just three quick conclusions, then, about historical pattern before I move on to distinctiveness. First, neither German unification nor generational change have had much effect on this historical pattern in German attitudes. I'm not saying they've had no effect, but they haven't had a very significant effect. Secondly, and this is a kind of prediction, should German creditor state status erode, and if I make a prediction, one day it will, because it always does, creditor state power is historically transient. It comes and it goes. How long will it last? It could last for a very long time, beyond our lives, but it might not last for very long at all, for all I know. It will be transient. When German creditor state status erodes, then German attitudes to the euro area and to policy coordination will correspondingly undergo rapid change. Look at Britain in 1931. Look at the Bank of England. You know, from being the most conservative, the most radical of institutions. Who could have predicted that? Creditor state status is not an historical given. It's not a birthright. It is vulnerable. And of course, in particular in the German case, it is vulnerable to euro area contagion as well as to domestic policy failures. And we should not forget, for example, and my attention has been drawn to this more recently, there has been a continuing rapid decline in the share of investment in German GDP. Questions arise about what the impact of that will be on long-term growth potential of the German economy. And clearly this is an issue that needs to be addressed. My third conclusion on historical pattern is the following. If Germany's current attitudes to Greece and Portugal and others can be characterized as arrogant and bullying, then the same applies earlier to the United States, to France, and to pre-1914 Britain. Arrogant and bullying is how debtor states tend to see creditor states. It's not specifically a German attribute in itself, which brings me on to distinctiveness, historical distinctiveness. There are patterns of historical distinctiveness in the German case, and in three senses at least. Firstly, there is the particular German ordo-liberal mindset, about which I shall say something in a moment, and the domestic institutional arrangements that embody that mindset perpetuated. Secondly, there is a distinctiveness in the German case that comes from the way in which German euro area crisis management continues to be historically conditioned by attitudes towards the nature and exercise of sovereign power in Europe, about which I'll say something in a moment. And then thirdly, there's an aspect of distinctiveness that comes from being in a monetary union. Very simply, there wasn't a monetary union in the 1930s and the 1940s and the 1950s. There is now. After 1999, the economic crisis management is taking place within a monetary union, and that radically changes the parameters of risk management. Radically changes them. In what way? In what ways does being in a monetary union change it? I'll tell you. I have my views on this. Asymmetric bargaining power remains.
Germany has more bargaining power than the others. It's the creditor power, and it's a systemically significant power. It has bargaining power. And others feel it. However, it has less asymmetric bargaining power than it had before the monetary union was created. And the reason is simple. I talked about the threat of exit. Right? The threat of exit. The threat of exit erodes, if not vanishes. No one believes the Germans will exit the system. They're too tied into it. The stakes are simply too high. The uncertainties of departure are too great. No one believes the Germans will stay at the table. And the Germans will are in a weaker position than they were before. So you can't reason from the Maastricht Treaty negotiations, the Stability and Growth Pact negotiations of the late 1980s and then the 1990s, to the current crisis. The current crisis is taking place in different institutional conditions. What I want to do, I've got half an hour, I've got a little while to go yet, just say a little bit about ordo-liberalism, because it fascinates me. I'm interested in economic ideas and so forth. The distinctiveness of German ordo-liberalism, why it makes a difference, is that as an economic theory, it is principle-based. It is an edifice of rationally ordered, coherent thinking. And it gives a strongly didactic style to German argumentation in crisis management. In ordo-liberalism, you reason from clear constitutive and regulative principles about what is needed to safeguard a long-term stability orientation in monetary, fiscal, economic, and social policies. Now, the Bundesbank, of course, remains the principal institutional repository and beneficiary, if you like, from the ascendancy of ordo-liberal values. From the 1970s, in particular, it succeeded in identifying itself with the notion that it safeguarded, quote, German economic stability. Then, in the context of negotiating EMU, redefined itself as the guarantor of German stability culture being exported to the euro area. We will ensure that German stability culture is exported to the euro area. And since, of course, the monetary union was established, it has appointed itself to be the guardian of euro area stability culture. Now, let me just make some points about ordo-liberalism. The ordo-liberal didactic type of argumentation provides great intellectual coherence to German negotiating positions, has to be said. Hans Tietmeyer, in negotiation, was a phenomenon, an absolute phenomenon. He would hold the fort. He would hold, you know, people would listen while he deduced what the EU would have to do from principles. Basic principles. But at the same time, it contains risks for Germany, potentially for Europe as well. I must stress that the points I'm making are not based upon an hostility to ordo-liberalism, but an attempt to analyse its strengths and its weaknesses. One of its central problems is that when you have a principle-based approach to policy, this leads readily to fundamentalism, to the erection of clear red lines in negotiations. I mean, frankly, Jürgen Stark recently, who was, of course, he resigned from the executive board of the ECB. Jürgen Stark said, all the red lines have been crossed. Yeah. Big sort of fundamentalist statement from him. It is clear that if you enunciate sets of red lines derived from principle, you are going to constrain your room for manoeuvre in negotiations. Well, maybe that's a good thing. But you are going to constrain your room for manoeuvre in negotiations. A strongly didactic style threatens to impede agreement on terms other than on terms that could prove humiliating to others and provoke resentment. And it poses the question of whether ordo-liberalism can actually provide a self-contained basis for making complex and essentially moral judgments about how we cooperate in Europe. If one wishes to continue living together in a shared currency area, such judgments necessarily involve reciprocity, give and take. And you can see where that lies. It's the give and take between the solidarity of effort, we expect the Greeks to comply, Italians and so forth, with the solidarity of mutual insurance through banking, fiscal, and macroeconomic policy union. The question arises of whether ordoliberalism can yield a statesmanlike approach to euro area crisis management. And it's noticeable. One of the most important developments politically in the euro area crisis management was when Mrs. Merkel, in autumn of last year, backed Draghi's and the ECB's outright monetary transactions program, knowing that the Bundesbank had voted against it and was lobbying her to, on this issue, voted against it in the ECB Governing Council. This was a big, big moment, because the standard operating procedure in German economic policy management in Europe is you bind in the Bundesbank. No clear blue water between the federal government and the Bundesbank. Suddenly there was. Big area of blue water between the two. I think that was a very important moment. The second problem with ordoliberalism is it exposes German negotiators to criticisms of being hypocrites. And on a positive note, German negotiators, and Gerhard Schröder did this recently in a speech, can point to their own long period of wage moderation and structural reforms, Agenda 2010, all of that, as examples to others. You can do the same as us and you can have positive results. Well, that's not hypocritical, that's fine. The problem arises, however, when people go up to Angela Merkel at a European Council meeting and say to Angela Merkel, and when are you going to liberalize your services sector? And the Germans have no reply to that. Because ordoliberalism would tell you, you should be liberalizing your services sector. Utilities, professions, all of that. No. So there is a risk of being, you know, told you're being a bit of a hypocrite in preaching to others what you're not prepared to do to yourselves. Third problem with ordoliberalism. It can be accused, I'm hedging my bets there, aren't I? It can be accused of being intellectually limited by its historical preoccupation with 1923 and hyperinflation and its role in the collapse of, or the demise of, the Weimar Republic. It neglects to have an argument about why the Great Depression, what lessons can we draw from the onset of the Great Depression. So you can argue of ordoliberalism is not intellectually armed to deal with cross-national deflation and the implications of that for European policy coordination and liquidity provision. There's an issue there. The final limitation of ordoliberalism, I'm trying to get to, back up, it sounds as though I'm really trying to take it to pieces. I'm not particularly, there are strengths as well as weaknesses, but there is an unresolved tension at its heart. Really is unresolved. And it's the tension between ordoliberals who believed, like Eucken, who was one of the founders of ordoliberalism, who believed it had universal validity. It was the right way to make economic policy. It was in the grasp of all states. They either do it or they don't do it. But it's right, and it's the only way. And those who believed that ordoliberalism is culturally specific. It emerges out of the distinctive historical trajectory characteristics of Germany, out of its particular experience. If you believe the latter, then the notion you can export it to the euro area, it becomes deeply problematic, if not a source of illusion defined in those terms. And this tension is coming out into the open in Germany, between those who think it's a universal good, a universal prescription, and those who think it may be culturally specific and not exportable. And you see it in economic and political commentators in Germany who are beginning to look at a reconfigured and smaller euro area as a de facto Denmark zone. People who are like us in cultural terms believe in stability culture. Right, I'm going to, as one necessarily does, dealing with such a big topic, move on, and just say a few words, if I may, about the future and where I think we are going. We are seeing, I think, already the onset of a debate in Germany, albeit behind the scenes, about what kind of Germany and what kind of Europe. It was avoided at the election by Mrs. Merkel. It's not avoidable forever. It will have to be engaged with what kind of Germany in what kind of Europe. It is clear that the lesson of the crisis is the institutional and political architecture of the euro area was inadequate, grossly inadequate in many, many ways. It has become clear that monetary union is no mere self-contained technocratic exercise. We can't just rely upon the ECB to do it all. It is fraught with political consequences. It poses political choices. And the question is, what are those choices? And during the elections, I took a lot of interest in talking with advisors to the political parties. And they were very aware of the need to engage in a debate about the fundamental choices, but the difficulty of so doing. There is a sense within, not just Germany, but of course outside Germany as well, that the logic of the euro area, it has been a hollowing out of democracy in the member states. And obviously the elections and party politics and all those sorts of things are much less fruitful and meaningful than they ought to be. So you get claims about EMU having contributed to a democratic deficit, that the European state is somehow suffering asphyxiation at the hands of the markets, the bond markets and the foreign exchange markets, whatever it may be. And there is a sense also that by a kind of ordo-liberal fixation on institutionalizing fiscal austerity, that asphyxiation of the state has been entrenched almost for good. This is a position taken up by Wolfgang Streeck and others in the Max Planck Institute for Social Science Research in Cologne. They're very close to the SPD and wanting to initiate a debate about fundamental political choices in the SPD. A fear that those analysts have of a nightmare scenario in Europe, that electorates could turn against the European project because they feel the European project, in a sense, is denying political choice and is eroding the value and meaning of the democratic system. Now, those who believe in that narrative of the crisis, I call that a narrative of the crisis, that is one of hollowing out, portrait of a dysfunctional euro area, generates two fundamentally different political choices for Germany and Europe. One solution, of course, is to embed EMU in political union at the European level, to make the big jump. Habermas and others, Jürgen Habermas, has very much advocated this kind of response, that EMU requires a clear central institutional capacity to take decisions in fiscal policy over rules and over fiscal transfers, banking supervision and regulation, bank resolution, structural reform. You need a central capacity. In a recent article I published in the Journal of European Integration, I argued that the issue that needs to be engaged with in the euro area is the issue of whether and how it should create a supreme emergency capacity. In short, any polity that wishes to ensure its survival must have a capacity to act in supreme emergency when its survival is threatened. The euro area hasn't had that capacity. Now, you could say, well, it doesn't have the political legitimacy to have that capacity. Fine, but it doesn't have it, and that's the problem. And you know, of course, the outright monetary transactions programs, the interventions promised by the ECB under very strict conditions in the sovereign bond, in the sovereign bond markets, the secondary market, is a move in that direction. I absolutely accept that. But the sense that there is not the central capacity to act in an emergency, to me, is absolutely fundamentally important. Even liberal, you know, theorists of a liberal society like John Rawls have argued that you need a supreme emergency capacity in any state. But to have that, you have to have political legitimacy. You have to have some kind of fundamental sense of a demos, of some kind of sense of shared value and mutual trust. Well, the Habermas argument I have much sympathy with. I don't think there's much way around it in many ways. But it does pose some very difficult issues. What kind of union are we talking about here? How much union does one need? How much central capacity is required? All these sorts of issues. I mean, if we're going to have fiscal transfer mechanism, what's it for? What's its purpose? How far should we have one? Should banking union include joint liability for bank resolution and for deposit guarantees? And so on and so forth. Many, many questions arise. I'm going to them now. But, of course, the doubts that emerge about whether this remains politically and institutionally feasible. Mrs. Merkel has drawn the conclusion it's not. She has drawn that conclusion. It's very clear. The interview she gave in Der Spiegel magazine in May made very, very clear her view with no treaty change. We do not want to run the gauntlet. She remembers the European Constitutional Treaty. In good times, it failed. In bad times, very, very, very risky strategy. So in many ways, the EU seems caught up in a vicious circle on that. There is another answer to the question of democratic deficit, and that is to roll back the EU. Roll it back. This is what is envisaged by Strack and others. They want to reverse back to 1998. They want to reverse back to a stable managed exchange rate system, keeping the euro as a residual competing currency. And in that way, you get a number of advantages. They argue you can restore choice in domestic politics. You can enable policies to be better tailored to the specific and very heterogeneous economic structures, historical trajectories of economic development in the member states. Also, it would have the, quote, additional advantage. It would keep Britain involved because, hey, the British always wanted this in the first place. Remember the hard AQ plan, competing currencies, all of that? It would avoid splitting the EU, which you get with a political union. So it would avoid splitting the EU in such a way as might otherwise happen, and it might possibly avoid British disengagement from the wider EU, if that is a benefit. It raises difficulties. I look with amazement on this argument. What would it imply for the conduct of monetary policy? The Bundesbank has been a consistent critic of proposals for competing currencies. It's always shot them down. It stressed the principle of the indivisibility of monetary policy. It really wouldn't want to go down this route. The Bundesbank would be absolutely opposed to it. It would also have the political benefit or downside of being a triumph for British ideas. Told you so. Would always end up like this. Secondly, abandoning the euro would pose the challenge of how to unwind the euro area without unleashing potentially uncontrollable financial and economic consequences. Arguably, integration is less politically challenging than disintegration would be. Member state elites are not going to grasp this option because they shy away from radical uncertainty. And the other issue with this solution is it could roll back the single market potentially. And that is also a great fear. But let me put another argument to you. And it's not a fashionable argument, and it is a Germanic argument. And it is, in a sense, a belated reference to back to ordo-liberalism. there is a potentially very different narrative of the logic of a monetary union. In this argument, the problem is not that democracy in the member states is being hollowed out. The problem is not a democratic deficit. The construction of a European stability union, this is what Mrs. Merkel calls it, offers arguably a functional framework for ensuring sustainable economic, fiscal, and monetary policies in the member states. In this argumentation, the problem is a different one. The problem is that there are serious deficiencies in the practice of liberal democracies. Liberal democracies are not perfect. We get slightly anxious sometimes about this kind of argument, but think about it for a moment. It is, by its nature, liberal democracy, spatially and temporally bounded. It's a particular set of people in a particular place voting about themselves and their interests. If it is to survive, liberal democracy needs to be made fit to survive and prosper in a fast reconfiguring world of challenges. Demographic change, particularly. We haven't got time to go into that now, but global competitiveness as well. Partisan democratic politics has serious difficulties in factoring in what economists like to call negative externalities, things that are going on out there. It also faces the problem of social justice. Is the socially just solution the one that commands the majority position at a given time? Is it? Is that how we think of social justice? What about social justice with respect to future generations and the distribution of costs and benefits across generation? You can make out an argument for robust European and national institutional arrangements to constrain the bias to short-term, inward-looking indulgence in economic, financial, and social policies. You can make out a case for these kind of arrangements to secure the long-term financial as well as monetary stability of a union. You can make out the case for robust European institutional arrangements to enable states to better address the demographic challenge of population aging. I'm just going to finish with this observation. I'm sorry if I've taken up too much of your time. I've spoken for 50 minutes, and that is more than enough at this time. You've been very good, very kind. this statement about this, if you like, a rational and technocratic vision of a Europe in which the democratic process is improved in certain ways by institutional arrangements that enable a stronger focus upon the longer term and the wider and a wider spatial type of thinking that we currently see happening inside our democratic process. This rational technocratic vision isn't enough. It never can be. It requires political legitimacy. Are member state governing elites prepared to comply with fiscal rules? Are they prepared to honour contractual arrangements of the kind now envisaged by the German government in policies for growth and competitiveness? Is this expectation simply naive, given the scope that we know member state governments have to practice fiscal gimmickry, to renege on commitments and find good reasons to do so? Part of the problem of life is there are always good reasons. Right? Always good reasons. It's hard, for me anyway, to see how the challenge of putting in place even a stability union can be constructed without the deepening of political union taking place. I could reflect, and I haven't, and I know you would like me to, because I'm not. I mean, we can do it in questions, if you will, on Anglo-German relations in the context of the euro crisis. But I think it will be now a good time to stop. Do you think? Yes. Thank you.
Good evening, everybody. thank you very much for inviting me and being able to comment very briefly on a most interesting speech, with which I have not much, dissent. But I want to take up this major, hypothesis of Kenneth Dyson, namely that Germany is the reluctant and vulnerable hegemon. I agree with that, but it is above all the weak hegemon, and in a way cannot play the role that a hegemon should play. In Charles Kindleberger's theory in 1973, basically when he said the United States hegemony is gone and can we survive that in a world where there is not a supreme power that can provide the public good of international monetary stability, he said that is the role of the hegemon in an international monetary order, and you can look at the euro area as one like that, because we have still fiscal authorities that are national, that it has to provide this stability through liquidity, solvency, and adjustment. It has to help the other countries to do that after a crisis and in a crisis. When you look at all these three things, and I did that because many people have now revived this theory, you can just show that Germany has neither the liquidity, because it doesn't have the central bank. The central bank is a common one. The solvency, it is too small to provide that much. For example, in Greece, its own banking system wasn't exposed enough so that one would say, okay, if the Germans pay up or take the hit for its banks, then that would be enough to save Greece, to save the euro area. French banks were actually more exposed to Greece, and so Germany couldn't do it on its own. And with adjustment, well, since then we see that Germany is reluctant to help with adjustment. Is that a bit unfair when I say this? I don't think so. Germany has made sure that it doesn't pay or doesn't incur liabilities that are disproportionate to its own GDP. It has established that every underwriting of the emergency fund is according to the key that the European Central Bank uses, and that is roughly just the share of your GDP in the euro area. Of course, Germany is the biggest, and therefore it must underwrite the biggest one, but it has actually made sure that it is only proportional. Now, we will know that this is not tenable. There will be a third Greek rescue program, partly because the second one was actually one that wrecked first the Greek banking system, and then one wrote the recapitalization costs back on the Greek books. This was such a badly done adjustment program that it is scandalous, and to some extent the Greeks are right that they're very angry with Germany, other powers who didn't prevent that, because basically everybody wanted to get its banks out. The only ones who held still Greek debt, sovereign debt, were Greek and sovereign Cypriot banks, and then one said, write down your claims, and only those private claims against the Greek state by 70%. They had to do it, and then they were insolvent. And then you took the IMF program to basically bail out these banks, and that is back on the Greek government's books. So Germany has supported things that were extremely not helpful in adjustment, and that will hurt it in the long run. Because in contrast to Kenneth Dyson, I do not think that the EU or the euro area can be saved by having this supreme capacity of a central capacity to fight a crisis. Once the crisis breaks, you're gone. This is too big for any member states, and even for this club of the Dutch, the Germans, Luxembourg. They are too small for this. And it has to do with, and this is the real failure of the whole euro crisis management under the German leadership, which was a leadership that always tried to not have to take the leadership and the responsibilities of a hegemon. The crisis that will then happen, the real failure was that when exposed these countries, first Greece that has brought it upon itself, Ireland, then Spain, than Portugal, countries where I would argue they didn't bring it on themselves, when exposed them to the market discipline of markets that had just badly and catastrophically failed. We allowed them to discipline these countries or exercise their rule in markets, which is pro-cyclical, getting a country that is already in trouble into deeper trouble, and those who do relatively well, like Germany, getting even cheaper finance and so on and so forth. And this is the real failure, that it actually, under the German leadership, and this is perhaps what is then covered up, I totally agree with this escapist ideology of order liberalism, it has allowed the markets to rule, and it doesn't make any difference of whether you're in the euro area or whether you would be actually on your own outside of this club. And to that extent, it is politically a very bad failure of what has happened in this euro crisis, perhaps more than the unprecedented economic crisis in which failures and mistakes were bound to be made. It is that nobody protected the other members from the onslaught of failing markets. Thank you very much. I'm supposed to lead the... Who would like to start? I take you first. Briefly introduce yourself, please, and... I think you have to speak up a little bit.
I was really interested by the way that your description of the way that creditor states act and have always acted, and in particular this idea that there's a strong incentive for them to coordinate with each other, but also that for debtor states it's harder for them to act collectively. Two questions. One is, under what circumstances, I mean, are there examples where debtor states get together and do act collectively, and what makes them do so? What makes them overcome those difficulties with the collective action? And then secondly, in terms of the creditor states, what strikes me is you talked about the creditor states within the Eurozone, but if you expand that globally, there's a sort of an even more interesting dynamic, which has been Germany and China as creditor states on one side of the argument, and the US and Britain and Eurozone debtor states on the other, which is obviously very alarming because it splits the West right down the middle. Do you perceive that happening too, that Germany and China are coordinating on policy as well?
Could we take two more and then one group?
I think we should do it.
Yeah,
let's do that.
The gentleman over there.
Vernon Bogdanor, I'm very fascinated by what you said about German policy, and you talked a lot, it seems to me, perhaps appropriately, in terms of abstractions. I mean, using terms like central capacity and greater integration and so on. And of course, what these mean, presumably in the European Union context, is that a country may be required to do things it wouldn't necessarily choose to do on its own. And this is something that perhaps hasn't been debated as much as it might have been in Germany, for two reasons, I think. First, because of the obvious fear in the immediate post-war era of discussing national sovereignty at all. And I think for this reason, Germany, though it may have been an economic hegemon, certainly wasn't a political hegemon, at least until the end of the era of Helmut Kohl. It was very far from being that. And therefore, one couldn't confront, in a way that perhaps we confronted rather earlier, what it actually means to sacrifice national sovereignty. We confronted that very early on because of our long, deep-seated evolutionary tradition of parliamentary sovereignty. We understood in concrete terms what the sacrifice of parliamentary sovereignty meant. Now, you didn't have this debate in Germany. You didn't have it very much in France because of the accident of Gaullist success, where again a country exercised its sovereignty for many years within the European community, as the European then was. But now with the economic crisis, countries are beginning to confront what it actually means in concrete terms to sacrifice national sovereignty. And countries which thought that in rhetorical terms they were willing to do it, now find perhaps they are less willing to do it. Now, the current crisis has been dealt with by on an intergovernmental basis, perhaps stretching intergovernmental institutions to the very limit. And the question that Germany has to face is, does it really favour a European Union, which means a sacrifice of sovereignty, doing things you otherwise wouldn't want to do, perhaps being outvoted by other countries, or is Germany much more British than we really thought?
Thank you. Gentlemen over here.
Thank you. I'm Lionel Koplowitz. I'm a past president of the Board of Deputies of British Jews. Now, you know, we've been talking about the European Monetary Union. And the first thing to recognize, and the creditor states, and that they all coalesce together, the five, and the debtor states, they can't, with their own particular interests. But let's acknowledge one thing. The whole thing was built up on a false premise, because certain states like Greece got into the European Monetary Union where it didn't meet the criteria for entry. And that's Greece is the worst offender of the lot. And why was it? When Greece has got into trouble on so many occasions with so much heartache and hardship for the individuals, why wasn't Greece told to exit from the European Union, to go back to the drachma, to devalue, and then to become competitive and economically sound? Now, this is a key issue, and nobody seems about to address this issue, because what Greece should have done, the other countries in the pigs, that's Portugal, Ireland, Italy, and Spain, should also have had to possibly consider. I'd like to hear your views on this.
Okay, I think you should now take it.
I will start with the end and work forward. It's interesting. Professor Helmut Schlesinger, who was the president of the Bundesbank at the time when the Maastricht Treaty was negotiated, was interviewed in a German magazine. I think it was in January 2012. It was fairly recently, anyway. And he said, looking back, he said, "We were naive." We were naive. We thought that if you put the rules in place, the rules were clear and firm enough that states would comply. I read this in disbelief. I reread it. Yes, this is what he said. I think what this reminded me of is a certain type of formal legalism, the notion that, in other words, if the rules are there, they're there to be obeyed. And within the EU, there is a very pronounced legalism, and the notion that when you have a set of criteria, like the convergence criteria for joining in the euro area, when you have such a set of criteria, then you apply them in the same way. Thank you. I would love a drink of water. Same way to all member states who apply. And what is fascinating is to see is that Greece got in. In 2000, it was 2001. Lithuania, of course, in 2006 was denied entry, perhaps for very good reasons. But it is striking, that Lithuania was ruled not compliant, even though it only failed by a hair's breadth, whereas Greece was. I think what this brings home to me is two things. One is the legalism issue. The legalism issue, but the issue also, and I think this really does need thinking about whether the convergence criteria were fit for purpose. I think looking back, one wonders very much about that. Really, what comes out from the experience of the euro area crisis is the issue of state capacity, the capacity of states. Well, it's a matter of political will and state capacity to actually deliver on commitments. And this is highly variable. We know this. It has come as a shock. And it has raised all sorts of issues. People like Soros, Soros have spoken about this, whether culture might matter, that culture may well be an important underlying factor that whose importance has been brought home to us by the crisis. We are where we are. We are where we are. We have to move forward from this position. We have to find a way forward with Greece, and hopefully with Greece is the answer. Sorry, the question then was about... Vernon.
The Dracula.
Yeah, well, the Dracula's gone.
We are where we are.
We are where we are. Yeah, we are where we are. We haven't got the Dracula any longer. Right, coming to this, the question about sovereignty. I agree with everything that you've said. I would just add the following remarks. For Germany in 1950, 50, 51, 52, 50, and onwards, there was a positive-sum game at work on European integration. In short, European integration was about restoring sovereignty. It was actually bound up with the process of restoring sovereignty. So, it wasn't that German negotiators were unaware of sovereignty. They were very, very aware of sovereignty. It was about re-establishing sovereignty and finding a way of doing this. And, of course, through European integration was one way of doing it. But in terms of attitudes to sovereignty in Germany and the difference from the UK, much of the political science literature on Germany is about, you know, what has been called the semi-sovereign state, a state which has institutionally built into it, through its constitutional arrangements, the sharing of sovereignty at different levels. And this creates a nice fit, in essence, between the way in which policy making takes place at the domestic level with the way the EU is evolving. So somehow, the kind of coalitional behaviour you get, not only in party political terms, but also in federal state terms in Germany, is paralleled with, fits rather nicely with that which you see elsewhere. Whereas for Britain, with our inherited notions of crown and parliament and so forth, sharing sovereignty notions are much more, I mean, the devolution issues and all of that. But I think this is, of course, is very interesting, but the core of your remarks, I think, were, well, Germany has now restored its sovereignty, but European integration is beginning to pose challenges for Germany, exposing it to not just to vulnerabilities, but to issues about whether it is right for Germany to comply with what the EU may be wanting. And you have, really, more recently, this commission in-depth investigation of the German surplus. I don't think that will go anywhere, by the way. I don't think that's going to be a problem at all for Germany to see off. But it does raise this issue considerably. When I did the book on Germany and Europe with Klaus Goetz, we referred somewhere in the introduction, I think, to European integration being part of the genetic code of German politics. What I think we really had in mind there, of course, is the extent to which, in a sense, in the preamble of the Basic Law, you have a fundamental commitment there to support peace and in Europe through European, closer European integration. There are no equivalents of that in the UK. The frame of reference of debates about sovereignty simply is very different. But, I mean, I have sympathy for what you're saying in another sense. I think what we are seeing with Merkel is a distance that has opened up between her approach to European integration in this crisis, as sketched out in her Bruges speech of, October, November 2010, and more recently in the Spiegel interview, which is what she calls the Union Method, where she sees the member states having a much more important role in the integration process, moving away from the community method, which empowers the Commission. She's become very anti-Commission, and in many ways, ways that would be wholly compatible with French views. The Union Method could be a French view. It's not wholly incompatible, perhaps even with British views. But it is interesting, you talk to people in the CDU and they say, this has got nothing to do with the party programme. Party programme is all about the community method. It's all about deepening political integration through the community method. And Mrs. Merkel is pushing this through. The interesting thing, I mean, I didn't mention this at all in the talk, but it's in the paper, is one of the things I I came across when I was in Berlin, became aware of, is as Germany has become more isolated, remember in mind when the crisis started in 2010, the informal creditor state club was five states, and it accounted for something like 60% of the GDP of the euro area. It's now four states, and it accounts for 35% of the GDP of the euro area. Yeah. The informal creditor state club has declined very considerably. The corollary of that is the evolution of the Merkel system. I'm not trying to establish a causal relationship here, though I might, you know, speculate privately about that. But Mrs. Merkel has posted people all into all the senior positions in the EU power structure. If you look at this, you know, the Secretary General of the Council of the EU, who is that? Corsepius. Corsepius was the head of her European division until 2011. Corsepius is now the right-hand man of Van Rompuy. That, of course, is wholly consistent with driving through the union method, the speech on the union method of Bruges, written by Corsepius. Now, and if you add to that, of course, Asmussen, who was the state secretary in the finance ministry, who's moved to the European Central Bank Executive Board, Jens Weidmann, who was her personal economic advisor, who's now president of the Bundesbank. You've got two of her most intimate advisors in the governing council of the European Central Bank, alongside Draghi. You've got a key person in the council of the EU.
Because we're approaching 2 hours.
Oh, I'm sorry. There was a question, I do apologise.
There was a question about creditor countries versus...
That was a really difficult one. That was a really difficult
China.
One. Germany and China. No, I think there are, I mean, clearly there are problematics in any kind of Germany-China sometimes, you know, you end up in agreement without necessarily having to formally coordinate what you're doing. You just end up having the same argument. That's all. And I think that is what you might be seeing happening in some of these instances. But what you're seeing inside the euro is something different, which is namely, a much more intimate and dense network. And it isn't just that the finance ministers of the informal creditor state club meet at regular intervals and typically before key ECOFIN meetings. It isn't, and certainly before rescue programs are decided. It isn't just that. It is other things. It's video conferencing, emails, things that are much harder to get at. But if you talk to people in the system about informal creditor state coordination, they admit it is very intensive and has become more intensive as the crisis has evolved. But you asked me another question. It was about examples of successful debtor state coordination. Bit stumped there. Yes, please.
The EPU was an example of
debtor.
The EPU? Yes. The monetary regime that most favoured debtor states. Britain wanted to make the plan convertible in 1952 with Operation Robot. It didn't. France was able to run up huge deficits throughout the 1950s. All the debtor states were able to settle in soft currencies with an increasing amount in gold, but it didn't fall until 1958. Mm. And so they all benefited from the increase in trade, which that soft currency system enabled them to finance.
Mm. Yes. It required the US hegemon to support with its currency.
Yes, but only with an initial injection of dollars. And also
underwriting the system.
So it wasn't just Europe. Mm. And France had to devalue at the end, but it still was an alliance of
interests. Yes. Well, donor states have a much stronger interest, of course, in the establishment and growth of international policy coordination of this type. That is absolutely by definition true. My point again about the very fact of numeric disadvantage that pushes the creditor states to have to really get their act together within that sort of system. And you get some, what I find very interesting is how the patterns change, even during the life of the EPU, very quickly.
One last round. The shorter you are, the more we can get in.
Thank you. I'm Peter Kramper. I'm a research fellow in history here at the German Historical Institute. I have two questions about your historical analogies, and particularly referring to order liberalism. First of all, you said that the German case was different from the previous cases because it was based on such a principled approach. Now, you could, of course, argue that the French position in the 1930s is very principled. It's based on a very coherent, intellectually sound set of economic principles. They were wrong, but they were coherent. So what really is the difference between the German case and the French case in the 1930s? Secondly, is it really helpful to characterize the German position as uniformly informed by order liberalism? It's sort of historically, that is certainly not the case. I mean, Helmut Schmidt's statement that he would rather have 5% inflation than 5% unemployment doesn't really sound order liberal to me. And is it, would it not be more useful to think about it in terms of sort of a Bundesbank view, maybe, and other views competing with each other? And isn't the interesting question then why the order liberal view is so important nowadays? Yeah, thank you.
Well, just one quick observation, Richard Overy, sorry, one quick observation and then one question. One quick observation, of course, is you talked about the history of creditor states and how they behave, but isn't it equally important to think about Germany as a debtor state? The crisis in the 1920s, when the hegemon that was keeping Germany afloat, in fact, showed its own vulnerability. And I think that one of the reasons why the Germans are so keen, of course, not to give away their gold is precisely because our history tells them that hegemons are potentially weak, and you've got to be very careful about how you act as a lender of last resort, if you like. But the question I want to ask you, actually, since we're in Britain and there's a British audience here, is that you didn't reflect very much on Britain's role in the last 10 years through the euro crisis and up to the present. And the problem is that in the British case, the politics and economics are linked very closely together now, perhaps disastrously so if we get a referendum in 2017, which is against the membership of the European Union. Do you see, in the future, a bigger role that Britain can play? I mean, Britain is a major economy, a debtor economy, a major economy. Could you say something about, where Britain would play a part in this? Because I feel very much rather, we're sitting here on the outside looking in all the time.
Thank you very much. My name is Gunnar Beck. I teach EU law at SOAS, and I also practice at the bar. Thank you for this wonderful lecture and almost outline of application of rational choice criteria to the problem, which I found very, very persuasive. But anyway, I mean, 3 points, very briefly. First, I think you've said very little about, shall we say, Germany's very peculiar, I think, and at the same time very understandable, I think, response to many political problems after the war, namely a kind of flight into more integration and how that may have influenced recent events. I mean, secondly, what influence, if any, do you think it may have made that Chancellor Merkel is East German in the sense that she did not grow up, one could say, as many West Germans, with a particular commitment to currency stability. And thirdly, I thought it may just, I mean, you were slightly cavalier, I think, in brushing aside the frequency with which rules tend to be broken. You called it a kind of legal formalism, but if Saint-Just said during the Terreur that terror was the order of the day, now it's law-breaking which has become the order of the day in the Eurozone, hasn't it?
Right. Okay.
Yes, please.
Okay, sorry. Okay, well, I'll go the other way this time. I'll start with your questions. I think what all of these questions have just been put, I draw attention to gaps in my presentation. They're not gaps in the paper, because in a sense they're addressed in the paper. I'm sorry, you may not, you know, may think that's a terrible answer, but it is in there. In particular, to come back to you mentioned Helmut Schmidt. Let's mention Helmut Schmidt again. Helmut Schmidt in 1996 wrote a famous open letter published in Die Zeit, which was an attack, a rebuke, a public rebuke to Hans Tietmeyer, who was then president of the Bundesbank, accusing him of trying to sabotage the shift to the single currency by being basically a fundamentalist on issues of European integration. And his basic point was that Tietmeyer lacks strategic acumen. I mean, I think that is actually the words directly from him, strategic acumen. In my paper, there's a lot of emphasis on this particular challenge in German state to German statecraft of reconciling ordo-liberal argumentation, which is coming from various sources. I mean, you can plot them, where this kind of argumentation comes from, with other types of argument, coming from the foreign ministry, from within the chancellor's office, from other areas in Germany as well, which is namely about the enormous... it came out very, very, very clearly in the Steinbrück-Merkel television debate, where Steinbrück talked, but quite passionately, I thought, about Germany's historic and moral responsibilities in Europe. And this isn't about order. This was not order liberalism. You know, this was about the importance of peace and prosperity in Europe, what we have learned from the past. So there's a different kind of lesson drawing goes on by Germans. It's not simply about, 1923 hyperinflation, the dangers of that to social and economic and political stability. It is also a lesson drawing about the dangers of isolation in Europe, about how Germany was isolated in the past. This is the narrative of isolation and suffered encirclement. This must not happen again. Germany must not be left alone. Germany must engage positively with its neighbours and find common ways forward. That narrative is very powerful in Germany. You see it in Merkel. Merkel's speeches. Aachen, May 2010, October 2011 was the most passionate. I mean, I don't remember, if the euro fails, Europe fails. Very reminiscent of Kohl, by the way, in 1991, very reminiscent of that. Very much subscribing to that kind of narrative. It's not gone away in Germany. It's a very powerful and a very important narrative. And German chancellors are constantly trying to reconcile that. I remember when in the Road to Maastricht, we were looking at the management of the 1983 ERM crisis and how Germany managed that crisis. It was a crisis of the French franc. But it was very clear that there was Kohl trying to weld together in a negotiating position. Classic ordo-liberal arguments coming from the Bundesbank and other and the finance ministry with these wider strategic arguments into some kind of coherent partnering position, but with great difficulty. And it is a tension that you find continuously running through Germany. I think you were right about France in the 1920s. I wouldn't have any particular disagreement about that. I still, however, think there is something so... If one reads into German ordo-liberalism, it is a wonderfully rationally constructed edifice of thought. I have never been quite as convinced that the French was quite so... It seemed much more utilitarian and, hey, let's make it up. This looks like the right thing. This looks a good way to justify what we want to do. The German case, you actually believe, you get the feeling that people believe this. They really believe this. Moving on to your point about Britain's role in the euro crisis, is there a role for the UK? I think there is. I was having a discussion with a Dutch, former Dutch finance ministry official. Where are we now? Middle of last week, it was, yes. And, he was saying, we can't understand in the Netherlands why the British aren't more engaged, why they are so defensive. There's a very important agenda out there with which Britain should be able to relate. And making the comparison with the 1980s, the 1980s when Europe was faced with eurosclerosis, the British backed the single market programme and were very active, actively engaged in that process. And I remember myself being very actively engaged with that at the time. Now there is a big and active debate about restoring growth and competitiveness in Europe. Britain should be contributing actively to that. Reviving the single market programme. There's a big constituency out there for that in Europe. Very big constituency across Northern Europe. Mrs. Merkel and David Cameron would have very little disagreement on the importance of structural reforms, the global competitiveness challenge as a central one. And there is a really powerful sense you come across in Germany, where are the British? And I was talking to interviewing a senior German banker, and he said to me, where are the British in these debates? They're just not shaping the debates and moving them along. They're asking questions about repatriating powers, but it's all in negative terms, not in positive terms, of pushing the agenda forward. And that agenda could be about a negotiation about repatriating powers but a Europe-wide renegotiation, for which there would be allies. But there aren't allies because people do not want to sign up to a unilateral renegotiation position. It's a real missed opportunity, I think, to engage positively. I regret that terribly. Merkel is an East German, and does that make a difference? Does it make her, in some sense, as an outsider in these debates? I find that a very hard question to answer, really. What we know about Mrs. Merkel, she's a very cool, analytical, reasoning character who thinks her way through problems cautiously and methodically. And she's historical context. She's in a particular historical context, a particular institutional context, and she operates and manoeuvres within that. I think she is. I think she's very deeply engaged with the values that are characteristic, have become, we think of as characteristic of West Germany, and which she represents. I'm not sure that her East Germanness has made much difference. I can't see it anyway. Who asked me that question? I've forgotten. Sorry, I do apologize. Yeah, sorry. But we could maybe discuss that later. Maybe you have a different take on that. I personally don't see it. On rules being broken, well, of course, 2003, when the Germans themselves were accused of flouting the rules. And there has been a long debate about the problematic in council decision-making of sinners voting on sinners, and the extent to which you can really rely upon votes in council to protect the rules. That has certainly, you've got people like Tietmeyer saying precisely that, and that the best thing is to rely upon the financial markets to do the job. It's rules and it's markets. I'm not someone who simply accepts rule breaking as a norm or something that we should be accepting at all. I do not. I think if you sign up to something, I'm old fashioned in this respect, then you comply with it. And I think we should be very, 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 very strict on all of that. But we do know. We do know that state capacity is very variable, and we don't have a lot of it across Europe. It's very worrying.
On this happy note.
Okay, on this happy note, we don't break rules. We have wine after an event like this, and you all invited to join us for a drink in our library next door. But before we go across, please let us thank both.